Friday. It's Friday, October 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, some breaking stories. What is being called a small group of American ground troops will be heading to Syria. A gathering of nations in Vienna in an effort to come up with some solution to the continuing violence in Syria. You'll hear from VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. And we'll talk about a major change in what had been China's one-child policy. All of that and more ahead on International Edition. U.S. officials say a small group of American ground troops will be heading to Syria to advise and assist opposition groups. Initial reports say the Special Operations Forces' aim is to defeat the extremist Islamic State group. The announcement was made, still being made, by White House correspondent Josh Earnest.
The president does expect that they can have an impact in intensifying our strategy for building the capacity of local forces inside of Syria to taking the fight on the ground to ISIL in their own country.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden is with us. Jeff, you've been working on this for quite a long time now. What does this mean? How big of a change as far as policy is concerned for the U.S. government?
Well, it's interesting. The White House spokesman, whom we just heard from, Josh Earnest, was asked whether in such a way, is this not a game changer? And his response was, you are astute to make that observation. He said that to the journalist who asked him. The administration is painting this as something that is in line with the existing U.S. policy to take on the Islamic State, to ultimately degrade and destroy the Islamic State. And the senior administration officials who were speaking earlier tried to make this point that this is not a departure from the U.S. counter-Islamic State policy that's been existing. But there's also the question of what exactly are 50 U.S. Special Operations troops going to be able to do in Syria? And a lot of that depends, and we haven't heard very many specifics yet. They're going to be operating in northern Syria. Some of them are capable in leading charges, actually taking the fight to the enemy, in this case, the Islamic State. Some of them are, depending on which troops you send, whether it's the Delta Force, the Green Berets, some of them are very good at advising and assisting and getting the allied forces that they'll be working with in place to take on the Islamic State. But how much is that going to do? How much is that going to advance the fight if it's combined? Some of the analysts I've talked to say if it's combined with an expected assault on Raqqa, where the Islamic State has been holed up for a while and is really essentially their capital, in Syria, it could do something. Obviously, the U.S. Special Forces, if they engage in any sort of fight with Islamic State, it's something that the Islamic State has not seen before. But the question is, how's the administration going to do this? And the other thing that nobody's been talking about yet or articulated yet is, what is the ultimate end game other than destroying the Islamic State? Because in Syria, most of the experts you talk to, people on the ground say, look, it is whether you want Assad in power, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in power, or you don't want Bashar al-Assad in power. It's a civil war on that issue. Everything else is secondary. The U.S. is coming in and saying, for the United States, it's against the Islamic State.
Well, as we'll hear in just a moment or so, Pam Dawkins will be reporting to us from Vienna, where there are ongoing negotiations and talks between a number of international entities, including the United States, Russia, and Iran, but not Syria, nor the opposition supported by the U.S. What kind of effect will this have, and why has the timing been made when these talks are going on?
Those are some very good questions, and
that's why I asked.
And analysts, the administration isn't publicly talking about a lot of that right now. But what if you talk to analysts, you talk to people who have been on the ground, it seems that there are a couple of things going on. Obviously, Russia's made a strong power play in Syria to support the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Iran has moved significant troops. They may have up to 2,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps troops in there. In addition, if you add it all up, you add in Hezbollah forces, which is an international terrorist group that is pretty much does the bidding of Tehran. And then you add some of the Shia militias that Iran has moved in there from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Pakistan. You're talking about a ground force of about over 10,000, maybe more, there to support Bashar al-Assad. So that's one fight that's going on. You have the rebels taking them on. You have the rebels fighting other rebel groups. You have the moderate rebels who are fighting at times with the Islamic State. And then now you have the U.S. going in with, presumably in northern Syria, which would be with the Kurds, because that's where their stronghold is, going in and taking on the Islamic State. So again, what is the end game? The U.S. has been clear that there's no military solution to the civil war in Syria. Obviously, the U.S. is saying there is a military solution to defeating and destroying the Islamic State. But how those two will ultimately mesh together, we're still waiting for answers.
A lot of questions still to be asked and a lot of answers still to be answered. Jeff Seldon, thank you so much for being with us. Now, the other side of that story are those continuing talks, those continuing negotiations taking place in Vienna. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is covering the international talks aimed at addressing the continuing battle, or should we say battles, in Syria. Pam, the meeting, the first of its kind, includes Russia, it includes Iran, two countries that have long backed the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. Have you been able to glean any information as yet on to what that stance on the Syrian president may have had on any of the talks so far?
Well, absolutely. It's going to be a tough battle for the participants here, which includes diplomats from 17 countries as well as the United Nations and European Union, because there are two very distinct views on what the future of Syria should look like. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran both have foreign ministers here, and both of those countries have been consistent in backing the Syrian regime led by President Bashar al-Assad. And then you have the other side, which includes Saudi Arabia, which is a key rival of Iran, and also the United States and some of its Gulf state allies, who have been more focused on a political solution that does not include Assad for the long term. Earlier today, I asked Secretary of State Kerry if he was optimistic about reaching an outcome in the talks today, and he described the process as difficult. He said officials are trying, but that it is a difficult process.
Well, does that open the possibility then of reduced expectations?
Yes, and also there is a strong indication that there will be more talks along this line, that there will not be a final resolution today, but maybe that today's session will lay the groundwork for future talks on Syria's political transition. Also, of course, there are some key players that are not at the table today, one being the moderate Syrian opposition.
Yeah, and that brings up another whole specter of issues and questions, does it not, as far as who is the real target here? Is the target the Syrian president? Is the target the Islamic State? Who's the true target here? Where are they going with this?
The real target of these talks deals with the political transition in Syria. Of course, the Islamic State presence in Syria is always going to play a role in this. One foreign minister said earlier today that addressing the terrorist attacks caused by the Islamic State and other militant groups present in Syria is a primary focal point, and then the discussion needs to move to looking at ways to stabilize Syria politically.
So who is the power and who holds the power, if that's how we are to judge this, at these talks? Is it the United States? Is it Russia? Is it Iran? Where is the power and how is it being yielded?
It's fair to say that the United States played a key role in organizing these talks. These talks evolved out of meetings that Secretary of State Kerry had about a week ago, some of those here in Vienna with some of the U.S. allies. As far as who holds the overall power today, it's really more of a joint effort. Now, again, since this is the first in what's likely to be a series of talks, that, of course, could evolve over time, and you may see a country or perhaps several countries step up in sort of a lead role as the process goes forward.
Well, obviously, this is not the end. It is but the beginning of the story. And VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is joining us from Vienna and will continue to do so. Pam, as always, thanks so much. And from Vienna, let's move back to our studio here in Washington, D.C., where VOA and International Edition social media director, or whatever your title is, Andrew Palchette.
What sounds like a good title to me.
You don't walk around with a name tag on it, so, you know.
Depends on the day. It depends on what I'm doing that day. But
all right, for Friday, what's trending?
Well, this serious story certainly is. A lot of reaction thus far. A lot of questions, as we've mentioned. So a lot of the reaction is very initial, ranging from people saying, finally, we need to do something to help the Syrian rebels and defeat Assad. Other people saying Obama said he wouldn't commit troops and now he is. He's going back on what he said. People saying that Obama doesn't have a choice. He's getting dragged into this mess because of the global situation. And others saying that it could end up being a global war with Russia's involvement and the U.S. getting involved. So a lot of concern, a lot of questions after this initial announcement, people waiting for more information. And I know our White House correspondent, Mary Alice Salinas, is in the briefing room with White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest, tweeting right now about his remarks and as he answers some of those questions. So she's on Twitter doing that work, as are many other people.
And following him, we do believe that Secretary of State Kerry will have a news conference in Vienna. And I'm sure he's waiting for the end of the statement by the White House Press Secretary. What else? There has to be something somewhat flighty, right?
There is something a little lighter, is Halloween. So tomorrow is Halloween, October 31st, and people are already jumping on that, dressing up. But today is the last work day of the week before Halloween on the weekend. So people are dressing up around work. I saw some people when I went out to lunch dressing up, and people are taking pictures of that on social media. Not just people, dogs are a big popular topic. A lot of people dressing up their dogs and putting them in topical costumes. And it's kind of this, on social media, scary versus funny. Some people are going for the gore and the guts. Some people are going for some puns. And then my favorite thing that I've seen go a little bit viral is the Trumpkin. Someone took a giant pumpkin and painted Donald Trump's face on it. A lot of the political candidates are popular Halloween costumes this year. Donald Trump mask, Hillary Clinton mask. So you might see some candidates walking around your neighborhood asking for candy in the coming next 24 hours or so.
Yeah, ahead of Donald Trump, illuminated from inside by a candle, is somewhat frightening. Andrew Palchetsky is International Edition's social media guru, chief, whatever he wants to call himself. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists and engineers have spent a lot of time over the years trying to design and build robots that mimic human activities such as walking and talking. Now, a group of engineers from Oregon State University say that they've been able to come up with the most realistic human walking system for robots that has ever been created. The Oregon engineers base their human-like locomotion system on a concept called spring mass walking, which applies computer control to various mechanical systems. The idea, they say, would help robots maintain their balance, traverse rough terrain, and basically walk just like humans. The engineers say that with more research and fine-tuning, their system could give robots even more versatility and performance, and could also, someday, help people with disabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. Story broke yesterday, but it is a major story. It comes out of China, where they have ended their long-standing one-child policy and will now permit all couples to have two children. Plan was unveiled yesterday following high-level closed-door political meetings this week in Beijing. Analysts said a two-child policy, while a welcome move, will do little to help lift the country's declining birth rate or shrinking workforce. This two-child policy is a further relaxation after China in late 2013 allowed couples, one of whom had no siblings, to have a second child. Joining us is Mei Fong. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of a new book just about to come out. It's called One Child, The Past and Future of China's Most Radical Social Experiment. Mei Fong, thanks for being with us. Is it safe to say that this radical social experiment, as you termed it, has not delivered the desired results?
I would say that is correct.
Okay. All right. And, you know, what were some of the results? Why did they do it, and why have they ended it?
Well, China had, in the 60s and 70s, a major population boom. And, you know, China's always been a very well-populated ancient society, always lots of people. Even when Marco Polo came along, he was talking about how huge China was then, and we're talking a long time ago then. So the desire to have to control the population, slow down population growth so that there would be enough resources for all, that was very laudatory. The problem was they moved to a very extreme sort of a solution to try and solve a problem. And this has created a whole series of damaging consequences that are going to influence their future going ahead. Now China has too many old people, too many males, and too few workers for the future going ahead.
I wonder if they have too many single children. Well, as well, we're talking about family structure here, how single children get doted upon by their parents. Has this caused a sociological change in the Chinese family?
Yeah, it definitely has caused. There are about 100 million families with only one child in China. So this is a huge effect on Chinese society, and we're still trying to figure out in the long run how this works. Like on the balance and the good side, you know, single children have all the advantages and all the resources given to them, so they did better in school. But the problem with the minus side of it was all these effects of not having to share with siblings, selfishness. Now, some of this was removed over time with socialization in schools. So there was always this big debate, you know, are single children more spoiled and more sad? And the jury, I think, is still out on that. But what is clear is that a nation full of single children, it creates a certain sort of a mindset. For one thing, I've discovered, it creates a sense of burden, because don't forget that one little emperor that's doted upon and gets spoiled by a whole host of grandparents and parents is going to grow up and have to take care of that very same set of people. One person in the nation where already 25% of the world's Parkinson's sufferers is going to go to 60%, and then you're going to have Alzheimer's and all these things. So this one little emperor is going to be a little slave very soon.
Well, let's give you a plug here. What about your book? When does it come out? Is it available, and where can people get it?
Well, originally the book was scheduled to come out in February, but because of this announcement, we're pushing it forward. So next week, the book will be available as an e-book, and the hard copy version will be available in January now. Thank you for the plug, by the way.
By all means. Mei Fong, a fellow at the New American Foundation. We could go on and on with this interview. It's fascinating to me and to us, and I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mei Fong with us on International Edition. My name is Ira Melman. Let's move along now. A story from Africa. Nigerians suffering from 6 years of conflict between Boko Haram Islamist militants and Nigerian troops are getting some relief now from international aid groups. Two aid projects underway in northern Nigeria are benefiting children displaced from their schools and women who have been widowed by the fighting. VOA's Michael Lippin has more on that.
It may look like a formal classroom, but it's not. It's one of about 300 informal learning centers in northern Nigeria where students driven from their schools by Boko Haram militants can still get an education. Washington-based NGO Creative Associates International runs the learning centers with funding from the U.S. government's Agency for International Development, or USAID. The program relies on support from Nigerian community leaders who provide safe spaces for the traumatized children, says the group's director of education in conflict zones, Eileen St. George.
We can come in with great ideas and help mobilize the community to realize their own need and how it needs to be responded to, and provide them some of the technical capacity to build the knowledge and the skill sets to implement the program. And so we say support because we are there, but working side by side with the communities, with the local governments, with the state to make this happen. And they're bringing in these kids.
The U.S. NGO says more than 1 million Nigerian children have been displaced by Boko Haram's 6-year insurgency. The group's year-old education program is designed to provide those children not just with learning opportunities, but also psychosocial support and in-class meals. St. George told hashtag VOA that her group has so far enrolled 20,000 displaced children.
I would say we're touching just a drop in the bucket. And there's so many more children and youth out there. And when you help stabilize the children and the youth, you're stabilizing an entire family and the community around them.
In another program, thousands of widows who have lost husbands in the insurgency have registered with the International Committee of the Red Cross. The Red Cross is working with the Widows Association of Northeastern Nigeria's Bornu State to help the bereaved women to start small businesses with $200 grants. Amina Lawan used the money to buy 3 sewing machines and open her own tailoring shop. Her husband was killed 3 years ago.
When I become a widow, sometimes to eat 3 times is difficult for me. We hardly eat 2 times a day because no money. Before you do this to children, you do it to yourself, their school fees, everything is so hard.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, who took office in May, has ordered his military chiefs to quash the Boko Haram uprising by the end of this year. Human rights organizations often have accused the Nigerian army of violating human rights in the fight against Boko Haram. The army denies that accusation. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Let us update you now on the story that has been breaking throughout this afternoon. The White House says that sending fewer than 50 special operations forces for deployment on the ground in northern Syria will have an impact and intensify the U.S. effort against Islamic State, or Daesh. Without specifying the exact number, White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Tuesday that the new forces would amplify President Obama's policy of supporting local forces in Syria as they battle the Islamic State militants. Earnest said the forces will offer advice and support to the moderate opposition troops. But Earnest says it's not a combat mission. He declined to give any details on their role. You've been listening to International Edition from the Voice of America. Find us at voanews.com. Click on the Programs tab at the top, then scroll down. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ira Melman. See you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Ukraine for exercising their right to vote in the first round of local elections. Ukraine's democracy, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, remains resilient despite facing difficult economic conditions and Russia's actions in Ukraine, including the occupation of Crimea. According to initial reports from international observers, these elections largely reflected the will of the Ukrainian people and general respect for the democratic process. These local elections are an important step for Ukraine as it continues to move forward with difficult reforms to decentralize political power. This decentralization is shifting more decision-making and budgetary powers down from the capital in Kiev to local communities. The United States looks forward to a successful second round of elections on November 15th for those mayoral races where no single candidate received a majority of the votes. We further expect that those in Mariupol and other areas where voting could not take place to get a chance to exercise their franchise on November 15th, said Mr. Kirby. In the wake of Russia's move to illegally annex Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian-backed separatists staged an uprising in eastern Ukraine. For the past 17 months, they have been fighting Ukrainian government forces who are attempting to dislodge them from the Donbas. As a result, some 8,000 people were killed and well over 2 million have been displaced, about 1.4 million of them internally. The United States hopes that citizens living in the conflict zone, internally displaced persons, and refugees will soon have the opportunity to exercise their right to choose their leaders in compliance with Ukrainian law and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe standards, and as called for in the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.